Thank you so much for inviting me, Mark, and the meeting. My name is Rosie, and I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is July 5th of 1992. I just turned 33 years sober. I don't feel 33. I don't think I behave 33. I think the longest that I'm here, I think the newer I feel, for sure. I feel different. I feel deeply at 33, and I don't get away with a lot at 33, so I am very lucky and very privileged to be a member of the Bellflower Big Book Group. I like to say that I'm in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I think there's safety. I find safety in being in the middle of AA. And what that looks like, what that means to me, is that I have committed meetings that I attend on a regular basis weekly. I have commitments in those meetings. I sponsor a handful of the girls. I call them from the podium my anchor in AA, because I no longer get to skip a meeting here and there or go to meetings depending on how I feel. They're my biggest commitment, I think, and because I get to answer their calls, and we get to trudge life together, and what a big deal that is. Thank you, Daryl and Terry, driving all the way over here to hear me. Good luck. I don't know what you're going to get. I want to thank Gemma. Is Gemma still here? Yay. Thank you for coming to read, even though you were nervous. You know, it's a big deal. It's a big deal to not say no. How else do we get to know you? How else do we get used to being here? We are not professionals. I'm not a professional talker. I'm a member just like you guys. It happens to be my turn to be up here. You know, I'm not an authority. I don't know any more than, you know, your active average person in the room. I'm as human as anybody has faltered today. Who's faltered today? I haven't faltered today. Give me a second. No. It's a big deal is not say no. Regardless of how we feel, we may miss an opportunity. And even coming up here and saying that you're nervous, you know, it's okay. It'll pass. But I'm a total byproduct of Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything that you see up here that's decent in my life, you guys gave me. Not because my parents were bad parents, not because my childhood was awful. I don't think it was awful. But because I lost my way. I lost my way with alcohol and drugs. And it happened, for me it happened instantly. You know, I had my first drunk happened when I was 16. I was on my way to high school. It was out of a bottle of vodka. I chugged, no orange juice. And I immediately love not only the effect, I'm a drunk that I like the taste of alcohol. I like hard liquor. I like the burning sensation. I like everything that goes with the drinking. I like bottles. I like glasses. I like everything that goes with it. I'm not a stay-home drunk. I like going places. I like parking lots, hanging out. The bathroom here is kind of roomy. Right? We can get three or four in there, you know? I've always been social. I always love a party. I love driving to Tijuana, Las Vegas on a split second, just like that. I am not the kind of drunk that you know, thought about doing anything. Let's just go do it. If you dared me, I'm also one of those that if you dare me, man, I did it, you know? I had a good time. Throughout all my high school. And then again, we have to redefine what fun is. Because to me, you know, missing class, cutting class, you know, almost getting in trouble, almost getting caught smoking cigarettes in the bathroom, almost getting caught smoking pot in the parking lot, having the narcs looking for me. I mean, oh, that was fun and exciting. Hey, you? Love? That is so cool. It's what happens when you get old in Alcoholics Anonymous. you get to see all these little ones, you know, coming in, you know, and being a part of, and you see their lives flourish and their life come up, and, you know, this is something that you don't want to miss. It sounds like tonight I'm going to be back and forth. If I leave a story out, call me. We can chat. I got a couple hours on my way home, you know, call me. But I had a good time. I was one of those high school people that had a bottle of vodka in the locker. Nobody had to teach me that. You know, I intuitively knew how to buy a dime of pot. I've been working since I'm 14 years old. Like, nobody had to show me to do those things. Nobody had to show me how to cure the hangovers, you know. I always had a God in my life. I prayed for me not to be sick. I prayed for me to get home. I was always driving drunk. And looking back, I don't think that I drove drunk because I like driving drunk. I just needed the car. You know, like, I'm sure we had yellow cabs, right? I'm going to be 62 years old in a couple months. We had yellow cabs. It's just it never occurred to me to take the cab. You know, like today we have Uber. It doesn't. I needed my car. This is before beepers, before cell phones. You know, if you came with me and it was time for me to go, if you were not standing next to the car, you were staying. This is the kind of friend that I was. I lived in a one studio apartment with my mom where she babysat 12 kids at any given time. I lived in downtown LA, but I loved drinking at the Bonaventure Hotel Revolving Lounge. What alcohol did for me is it allowed me to be somebody that I wasn't. It allowed me to live in that state of delusion, and I loved it. I love piano bars. I love the Grand Marnier comes with the flame on top. I felt on top of the world, man, with my little fufu drinks and my long Saratoga cigarettes. I'm 17, I'm 18, 19. I've always had a fake ID. I don't know where it came from. That picture didn't even look like me. I never got in trouble for the ID. I always went places. It never was a problem. And I remember that in living in the place that I lived, I was poor. But I had 20 bucks that would get me going, you know. And I loved the effect. I loved what it did for me. And I quickly lost, you know. And maybe I didn't end up underneath the bridge. Maybe I didn't end up doing heroin. I didn't do a lot of the things that a lot of us have to do. But I lost me. If there was any, I'm sure that there must have been a little Rosie somewhere growing up. You know, I have pictures of somebody that looks somewhat decent. I just don't know when I crossed the line. We talk about crossing the line here, you know. I don't know conscientiously when that line was crossed. I think it was crossed the very first drunk because I was willing to do things that I normally would not do if I'm not under the influence of alcohol or drugs. And what happened to me is that I quickly lost me. And I would do anything to experience that excitement. You know, on page 164 where it says, you know, when we pray to be free from excitement, I remember pausing because I never saw excitement as negative. To me, you know, I'm addicted to that excitement. I'm addicted to that, not the drama, but I'm addicted to that. And I'm still very hyper. You know, it's like, you know, way too many cocaine, you know what I mean? 33 years later, I can still clean my house and your house, you know? And this is all after 9 p.m. And so I'm always been a little nuts, just a little nuts. And because of that, I'm very lucky that I didn't go to jail yet. I'm very lucky that I didn't end up in a sanitarium. I don't remember having the thought of taking my life while I was under the influence, but I know that I wanted to take my life at the age of 10. I was still in Nicaragua at the age of 10. This is before I ever drank and before I ever did anything that affected me from the neck up. And I wanted to end my life, and I drank rat poisoning at the age of 10. Lucky that I was found by a friend that, you know, made me puke, and of course, obviously, I didn't die. At the age of 14, I was completely humiliated in school, and I was going to be jumped by some cholas. And cholas were like the gang members of our time. And they made me kneel before them on Pico and Vermont in front of all the kids. And I wish that my story would be different. I wish that I would have, like, let them kick my butt, and so what? You know, I wish I can say that, you know, I ran away, but I didn't even have the courage of running away. I knelt before those girls, and I remember losing another chunk of myself. And I'm sharing that because those were the little secrets that I brought into Alcoholics Anonymous that allowed me, that continued to smash me like a cockroach, those little secrets. It wasn't the money that I embezzled. I embezzled a lot of money in my time, $7,000. I knew the amount because I filed taxes on it. Please don't judge me. I've made amends and restitution. Ha ha. This is for the people on the... Is this Zoom? No? Okay. I'm just checking. It wasn't the big stuff that I've done that I pulled. It wasn't the cunning of, you know, my friends to buy me drugs off me. You know how we are. You know, we give them a little sample and see what's going to happen. And because that's the kind of friend I am. And it wasn't none of that. It was the nickel and dime things that kept me feeling dirty and filthy in the inside. Somewhere along the line, I lost chunks of myself where by the time I got to you guys, I was a nobody. You know, I was dressing up with my sister's dresses, and a very vulgar girl is what I was when I got to you guys. And I use that word, and I mean vulgar. I don't use it lightly. I mean vulgar. I had not a sense of decency about myself. I didn't have any self-worth whatsoever. And I didn't know it. I thought I was having fun in those nightclubs. I went where people knew my name. And what happened to me, you guys, is that I quit doing drugs at the age of 19. I had an overdose. Nobody called 911. And I prayed to a God. I've always had a God. God works in mysterious ways. Because I didn't have the relationship as I know it today of a higher power, but I always had a God that I believed in. I don't think I was ever afraid of God. I knew that I was not in his goody, you know, list. That I knew. But I wasn't afraid to pray to a God. And at the age of 19, I remember having that overdose, and I remember praying to a God, and I remember, you know, not doing drugs. You know, I smoked a little bit of pot here and there because pot was not a drug. And I drank. And whenever you don't have anything to enhance your drinking, you're going to go into blackouts. And I had a lot of those. And I have those blackouts and coming in and out, driving, coming in and out with people, coming in and out by myself, coming in and out in my own room, and not knowing how I got there, and trying to recognize the ceiling, and jumping out of bed to see my car well parked in front of my house. No blood, no dents, no nothing. And I lived like that for a long time. And so what happened at the age of 19, from the ages of 19 to 25, I drank and smoked pot. I had good jobs. I'm a bookkeeper by trade. And I remember just trying to go to college. You know, it took me 5 years to get a two-year degree. You know, but that's what you do. I remember paying my niece $20 to take my algebra exam in college, and I remember laughing about it. You know, I went home and I told my sister, everybody was, it was a joke, you know. There was not an ounce, you know, of nothing. And I remember showing up to my business law class completely intoxicated and to the final, and I remember being kicked out of class, and it was a Wednesday night, and I ended up at the Quiet Cannon. I had a car that drove me to different nightclubs all by itself. You know, on Wednesdays we'd go to the Quiet Cannon, on Thursdays we'd go to the Grand, on Fridays we went to the Mayan in downtown, and on Sundays we would always at Stephen's Steakhouse. And this is how I know my days. And I remember that at the age of 25, I found myself still playing with the same playmates and in the same playgrounds. And that plate of drugs got passed around one more time, and I picked up. And I'm here to tell you that from the ages of 25 to 29, I lived what I call my bottom. And we all have different bottoms here, you know. And I think for me, a bottom is when you say it is your bottom. You know, you stop digging. It doesn't matter how deep it is. It doesn't have to go all the way down. But for me, it looked like this. I quickly shacked up with that drug dealer guy that I was with that I did not even like. The guy could not even dance, okay? He was not right. You know, he was not right. But I quickly checked up with him. He was married. He was supposed to be unmarried. You know the story. You know, when we talk about having those pitiful and incomprehensible demoralizations, I never had to look that up. I know exactly what that is. And for me, November of 1991, my brother had gotten back from Nicaragua with some beautiful rum. We made the best rum. And I had just gotten back from the Galapagos Island with homemade, sugary, thick alcohol. And I don't know if you guys have ever had that kind of alcohol, man, but it's just smooth all the way down and all the way up. I mean, you don't even feel it coming up. But once you make it stay down, it is the best high ever. And my brother is a lot bigger than I am, even though I was bloated back then. But he was a lot bigger than I am, and he got up to leave at 9:30 p.m. It was a Sunday, because I ended up at Stephen's Steakhouse. And my brother totaled his van that night. He hit the 101 and hit the wall on the 5 freeway, hit the center divider again, lost the wheel, ended up on the right-hand side without hitting anybody. And my brother got sentenced to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I went dancing that night. I came home, and the following morning, my brother asked me if I would go with him to pick up his van. We went to pick up his van, and we came home with $50 in the back seat of that van. That van was completely destroyed. I looked at the van, and I looked at my brother, because he walked away from that car wreck. And all he had was the burn from the seat belt here and a swollen chin from that wheel coming up. And he was fine, you know. But he got sentenced to go to AA. And I'm at this time, I'm working for a loser place in downtown L.A. where the men go and pay to dance with women there. And my job was from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m., and my job was to hire the women that work there at night. And I can tell you that second and inches we talk about here. We talk about but for the grace of God. Because if I would have been working anywhere else, I wouldn't have been able to pick up the phone for my brother when he called the first time he went to an AA meeting, January of 1992. And the phone call went something like this. I just came back from a meeting, and those people are crazy. I am not going to go back. I'm looking for somebody to sign my core card. I'm willing to pay for it. I have no idea what he's talking about, but he said pay, you know. And I'm going, whoa, you know. And my brother tells this story because I don't remember talking to my brother. But my brother said that I told him that I had heard Alcoholics Anonymous worked and that he should go try it one more time since he was the one always walking around the house saying he was an alcoholic. Now, I don't know why I would say that to my brother. I've never been to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. All I know about you guys is Sarah T. and my name is Alice. Those little junior high books we read back in the 1800s. And that's all I knew about AA, but my brother said that I told him that, and for whatever reason, he went to his second meeting and his third meeting, and by the third meeting, you had him. My brother became your biggest cheerleader, and he couldn't wait to tell me about it. He started calling me every morning after his morning attitude adjustment meeting. And I'm at the other end of the phone, and I am drinking my vodka, I'm drinking my tequila, I'm scoring my dope in that place. I'm no longer able to drive 20 minutes from downtown LA to Downey. I lived on Old River School in Florence in some apartments there where I was checked up with this loser guy that kept going back and forth to his wife. And I remember that my brother started calling me and talking about you. And my brother started talking about AA and God. God, 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 it was God. We're Catholics. We know God. We never, ever miss Palm Sunday. And at least once a year we go to church. But my brother was nuts. And he came home and gave all the siblings big books. Passed it out like it was candy, you know, and he's the only guy. We're all girls. We used to mock him. We used to call him Brother Mario. He'd be coming in through one door, we'd elbow each other and laugh, and we'd run away from the other door. And this old boy was on fire for Alcoholics Anonymous. He was on fire. And he was telling me what you guys called here the language of the heart. I didn't know this. I was drinking, I was minding my own business. Once in a while, I remember wanting to tell him where I was. I wanted to tell him that I was selling drugs, that I was using on a daily basis, that I was drinking every morning, that I would go to bed at 6 o'clock in the morning and I didn't have to be at work until 10 a.m. And I would try to sleep in a hurry for an hour, you know. I don't know if you guys have ever tried to sleep in a hurry. And then you get up and there's no time, there's no energy to take a shower, and you put your red lipstick on, because if I have my red lipstick on, everything is going to be okay. You know, and there's no showering anymore, but I wear perfume, and I think that accounts for something. And I live that way, and I live that way not a week, not 2 weeks. This is the way that I lived for a long time. I lived across the street from 2 liquor stores. And now, mind you, I always had money to go get the liquor. You know, and there were mornings where I would wake up and I would wait for that green light that said walk, and that green light would flash walk, and I couldn't move. And the liquor store was at the other end, and I had money to get my bottle, and I couldn't move. And it was like that over and over again, over and over again. And I wanted to tell my brother this, and the words didn't come out. I'm from a family where we don't air out our dirty laundry, especially to family members. We don't tell family members nothing. Nothing! You know, and here I was, and my brother was on fire for AA, and he kept saying, when you get to AA, when you get to AA, like he knew I was going to come to AA, he would say, when you get to AA, you're going to love Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember thinking, man, you're nuts. And he took a trip, he took a vacation trip, and he says, you know, before I leave you, I got to tell you that when you go to AA, you got to go where the literature table is. Thank you. Thank you for setting that beautiful literature table. Thank you for coming here early and setting up the room. You guys have a beautiful room. You know, thank you for everybody that has commitments and the raffles and the setting up and the coming in. And, you know, Mark is waiting for me outside in 110 degrees. And, you know, we came in with no makeup on, so we, like, pulled over. And I can tell he was nervous. You know, he was nervous, pacing back and forth. Is she coming? You know, so thank you for the people that have commitments in AA, because when I came to you guys, I was not an alcoholic. I came to you guys because my brother thought that I would love this place, and I wanted to see what you guys were doing to my brother. I did not come here because I needed you. I am full of false pride, and I'm full of crap. I live, the doctor's opinion describes me well, I live in a state of delusion where I can differentiate the true from the false. An outright mental defect is what it calls me. It also, the big book talks about King Alcohol. And when I'm reading all this stuff, I'm thinking, man, you guys are way too dramatical for me, man. You guys are drama, you know. I never saw alcohol as my King Alcohol, but how else can you call King Alcohol when everything you do is drink? And everything you do is for the drink. So what happened is that I got to my first meeting on a Tuesday night in Downey, and I don't know how I got there. I don't know if I called 411 or the Yellow Pages, but I ended up in my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's called the Second Chance. It's no longer there. And it was a beautiful lit room like this, and there were a lot of old ladies, like probably in their 40s and 50s, you know. And they had their little beehive hair and the beautiful jewelry, and I'm 165 pounds worth of bloat because I like drinking everything under the moon beer back. I'm drinking beer 24/7, and when you drink beer 24/7, you're going to be a little chunky, you know? I have no neck because I'm bloated. My chin is touching my boobs, you know, and I look like a bullfrog, you know? I look down, I have no toenails due to malnutrition, you know, and this is way before acrylics. You know, I always say, that's a vision for you, that there, you know. And I came to my meeting, and I looked around, and I thought, you know, God, this is another room where I don't belong. You know, I don't belong. You guys look way too clean and too happy. Just happy. You guys were happy to be sober. And I didn't understand. I didn't get it. Besides, I was not an alcoholic. I was just here to see what you guys were doing to my brother. I went to the literature table that my brother said to go to and pick up a directory. And a directory was that little book that had all the meetings in it. You know, now we have the app. But before, we used to have a hard copy of the directory of all the meetings around the area. I forget her name, but was at the literature table and waiting for me to get there after the meeting. And I tried to give her $5 in 1992 because you poor people needed the money. I mean, with all that false pride, you know, that ego, I looked at AA and I thought it was a step down. I thought, you know, it was across the street from a bar that's still there. It's called the Guardsman, where I drank. And I remember thinking, this is too embarrassing, you know, walk into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. Mind you that I can pee all over your front lawns any day because I'm a peer, you know. Some of you guys are pukers, I'm a peer, you know. But I'm embarrassed to walk into a meeting of AA, you know. And I walked into the literature table and I got a little directory and she laughed out loud. She says, honey, it's free for you. Are you new? You know, and I have no idea what she's saying, you know, and I laughed it off, took the directory, and waited for the following Tuesday. Mind you, the directory has every day, but I waited. In my head, it's every Tuesday. And I waited for the following Tuesday, and I went to a meeting in Norwalk, which is only 5 minutes from Downey, but I found a biker meeting. And this is the beauty of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is the beauty of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because you can go anywhere. You don't like this meeting, you can go to another meeting. And you can go to another meeting. And you can go to another. But get this. If you stay here long enough to hear a little chunk of your story, you may become one of us. Because this is what happened to me. I found that biker meeting and I sat there for a minute and I heard that your treasurer had gone to prison by his own admission. And I remember thinking, man, you people are some kind of stupid. You got the guy that went to prison, he's telling you he went to prison, and you're giving him your dough. And I remember intuitively thinking, God, you know, I'm gonna, you know, save this group. I gotta help you people out. You're helping my brother, you know, who obviously alcoholic, you know, but I'm gonna come and help you guys out. God works in mysterious ways, his wonders to perform. And I kept coming back to that meeting, and the old-timer at the meeting asked me if I could help with coffee. Then I knew you needed me. It was, you know, God, you're asking me to make coffee, you poor people. So I made coffee for you guys, and, you know, I'm watching that guy, you know, in 3 months you must have figured out that I was a bookkeeper because you asked me to secretary the meeting, you know. I intuitively knew you wanted me to audit the guy that was still taking your money. I mean, I'm watching him like a hawk, you know. And I'm a thief, remember that, you know. I watch people, if I'm a thief, it's all on me, baby. It's not that I don't trust you, as I explained, it's I don't trust me. You know, I am the cheater. I am the thief. I am the one, not you. So, but I'm watching him all cross-eyed, and I accepted the secretary commitment because you poor people need some help. I cleaned up your binder. I did the color coding like you guys did here. And, you know, I got your back. You're keeping my brother sober. I got you, you know. This is in my head. I'm still non-alcoholic. And I'm coming to your meetings. I'm not drinking in between meetings. I'm not using in between meetings. I remember my first 3 months, you know, landing on ERs thinking that I was having anxiety attacks and panic attacks because I did have the cold sweats. I stopped abruptly. I didn't know that if you stop alcohol and drugs, you can die. I didn't know that, you know, and I went through a serious detox not knowing that I was detoxing. And so I kept coming back to that meeting, you guys, and I kept watching your money and I kept doing your work. And in my heart, I'm doing this, you know, I am sacrificing and I'm doing this for you guys. And, you know, God disguised himself as a cute guy when I was about 9 months sober. I don't know if you guys have any cute guys here, but that guy had teeth. And and he invites me to go play volleyball at the speaker meeting. I've never been to a speaker meeting in my life. I've only been going to participation meetings, you know, to talk about feelings and flat tires, you know. And so he invites me to go play volleyball at the speaker meeting. By this time, I'm 9 months. I've lost all my bloat. I'm wearing my little hot short shorts and my little tube top. My neck is out. I'm ready to go play some ball. You know what I mean? And here I go. And I went to play volleyball. That was my purpose. That was my purpose. I would stay after the game because, you know, it doesn't look good if you don't stay for the meeting. I would stay for the meeting, you know, and I, you know, throw cookies at you once in a while, you know, just to make you think that I was a part of. And I'm there minding my own business, focus on the game. And there she was, Betty Garcia. She came to share with me on a November, you know, and it was raining and it was cold and she was old. She's about 60. And we didn't have anything in common, except that she danced on tables. That's about the only thing we kind of had in common, you know? But, you know, she was old and she had a hard life. But she said the third step prayer from the podium and the seventh step prayer from the podium. And at the end of her talk, she recited the poem by the touch of the master's hand. And I sat there and I was moved. God works in mysterious ways, his wonders to perform. I got up from that chair and I went to Betty and I said, Betty, here's my phone number. I normally don't ever give out my phone number. Like I was asking her out, you know. I don't give out my phone number, you know, but, you know, you can have it. And you know, God bless her, because if she would have given me her number, I probably wouldn't have called. She took my number and she called me the very next day. And I'm sitting with Betty Garcia at the Torrance Lomita Alano Club the following Saturday morning. And I can tell you people that my life has never been the same. This lady gave me a commitment instantly. She said, we need a liturgy person. And I said, no, Betty. I live in Downey. This is Torrance. It's 20 minutes away. I can't make it. And she laughed. She laughed and gave me the keys to the locker. And this lady, the following Saturday, I became their literature person for the following 2 years. And the following Saturday, she's asking me if I've ever taken an inventory. And I said, I don't know what that is. And she lit up. You know, she grabbed that book and she took me to the bench that's still there, a half a block from the TLC. And she sat me down and she started reading the big book out loud to me. And she would say things like, selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of all your troubles. And she'd stare at me for 30 seconds. I'm like, who the hell reads like that? What's wrong with this lady? You know, she's like, you know, on me, you know. And then she started saying how my family was dysfunctional, you know, and how that what I was wearing was very indecent for the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm almost 30 years old. I mean, like, nobody have ever talked to me that way. You know, I've been self-supporting since I'm 14. You don't talk to me like that. I remember that offended me, you know. But at this time, the meeting is 3 miles from the beach. I'm wearing my bathing suit and my little netting dress because I'm ready to go to the beach. You know, you understand. It's a morning meeting, you know. And she tells me that I can't be a distraction in the meeting. She tells me that, you know, I may not care for the meeting, but people in the meeting, this is their saving grace. This is their life support. And that I need to pay a little bit more attention and not to be getting up. That the break and before the meeting is to get coffee, you know, that I don't get to, because, you know, I'm walking around all cute, you know, chit-chatting with people, you know. It's like during the meeting, you know, and I'm that disruptor. And she started teaching me about caring about this thing that was going to not only save my life, but change my life. You guys have given me a brand new way of living, and I didn't know it. I didn't even know that I wanted a brand new way of living. I didn't know that I wanted a relationship with this higher power. I thought, you know, I believed in God. I thought that was enough. I was like Bill puts it, you know, I was going to be catapulted into the fourth dimension of existence, you know, by taking these steps. You know, and you take the steps thoroughly. You take the first 9 step. This program will work for you. It don't matter where you come from. It don't matter what you did. But if you work the steps in order with the sponsor thoroughly, thoroughly, there is no half-assing your fifth step. There is not doing your amends halfway. I'm getting chills. I know so many people that have come back out and never made it back in. I know people in prison today because of secrets. Secrets are a bad malignant tumor. It's not the action that's gonna get you drunk. It's your justification of it. It's not the action that is going to get you drunk. It's us justifying our actions. It don't matter what we have done, you guys. It doesn't matter. We can tell somebody else in confidence. We can tell somebody else and we can get help and we can get better. We can get better. I gave her a fifth step facing that wall of that Alano Club on a morning, Saturday morning. And, you know, I'm going to go a little fast because I want to make some amends here. But I was petrified of my fifth step. I had secrets. I had that money embezzlement. I could go to jail. I was afraid. I mean, it's things that I share with you behind the podium, you know, 31 years later, it sounds very easy. It doesn't mean anything, you know, to you guys. But it means the world to me because it's what's pieced me back together. Remember when I said, you know, I came in and I was nothing. I fit in my own skin. I'm comfortable today. I belong. I belong in meetings of AA. I belong in my seat. I belong in a home married to a beautiful man, member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I belong on my job. You know, I'm not working my 8 hours today. I can tell you and be honest. Oh shit, this is being taken. I can tell you that I'm not working my full time right now, you know, and they know it and they understand it, and you know, but such is life, you know. It turns out, you guys, if you guys stay here long enough, it turns out that when you guys say we are here for you, you mean it. I didn't know that. Because you don't know that until you need it. Okay? You can walk back and forth here and you can hear this. We're family. And I remember thinking, I ain't no family. You're not my family. You know, what are you talking about? You know, this group here is tight. I can see where you guys got it going on. But I'm over there. Always isolating. You know, I love it. And I don't know if it's shallow, but I love it when some of the speakers say that they want to be invited, but they don't want to go to the party. They just want to be invited. You know, I want to be accounted for. You know what I mean? I just don't want to hang with you. Isolation for me is beautiful. I love COVID. Woo! I can do COVID. You know, just let me be, you know. So I gave her my fifth step, and she told me what to do with my sixth and seventh, and I can tell you that I gave her a fifth step that was thorough. She wanted my resentment, my fear, my sex, and my secrets. So, you know, I let go of everything that I was. I had nothing, no reservations whatsoever. So when I took that seventh step, I thought I was going to be the next Mother Teresa of Calcutta. You know, I'm like, I'm clean. And I'm thinking it's going to be permanent. You know what I mean? I don't know. I was very naive, you know. I'm thinking these defects are going to be removed forever. Ha, ha, ha. You know, our defects of characters, wherever they are making push-ups as we speak when we are in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. They make push-ups, they get stronger, and they're always here. And they're waiting for us to be not paying attention. I mean, my experience. I don't know about your experience. My experience. My defects are here. They talk to me once in a while, you know, we put them in the back seat, you know, glance at them, yeah, I'm going to a meeting, you know, talking to my sponsor, picking up the phone, but they're here. And then whenever I am not paying attention, I also get caught by surprise. I'm a human being first and foremost. I'm going to err and I'm going to fall short. And these things are here and they are mocking me and they are alive. Alive, it's alive. I mean, they're freaking alive, you know. And it all started during COVID. That's for me, this time, right now. It started in COVID. And they haven't lit up. And I shied away, not from prayer and meditation, not from the meetings. I keep going, but I checked out inwardly. I don't know if you guys don't know what I mean. But I checked out inwardly, and I became separate from my higher power in meetings of AA, active, with the girls that I sponsor, doing my reading, doing my prayer. I just lost the connection. Defects of characters, alive, alive, alive. No connection with God. Big, big problem, big deal. Because when I am not connected, if you are connected all the time and you know it, you know, when you're not connected, you know it right away. And for me, it's a little panicky. So I, you know, tell my sponsor. My sponsor says, you know, call this person. I don't know this person. I hate calling people I don't know. This person tells me, you know, this is what I've done. You know, this is what helped me. And it was like a really weird practice with the higher power. I mean, weird. You know, I've never done anything like that. It sounded like, woo, you know. Yeah, I don't like that kind of crap. You know what I mean? It's like, okay, but here I am. You know, I'm writing this stuff and I'm responding to it. And I'm like, whoa, it's a two-way prayer. I think it's what it's called. But it's really weird. And so, but it worked for me. And I don't know when it happened, but I started connecting and I came back. And I came back to self. And that helped me. And that helped me for what? I love what the seven steps says. You know, remove from me these defects of character, you know, so I can become useful. Not so I can become comfortable, you know, and watch Netflix. It says remove the defects, you know, that are in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. God wants me to work. Man, he don't pay me no overtime, and I don't know if he believes on vacation, because he wants me to work all the time. He wants me to be kind. He wants me to be forgiven all the time, and what an order I can't get through with it, you know? But this is me at 33. You know, I was way better at 10, way better at 15. I gotta tell you, this is the worst I've ever been, I think, you know. And sometimes when we walk through life through hardships, you know, I don't necessarily say, why me? You know, there's no why me. It's not, why not me? You know, because life is life, and we are going to be bombarded with life little bullets. And Bill Wilson, on the page of 14 and 15, talks about self-sacrifice. If we don't self-sacrifice, we won't be able to survive the low spots ahead. It doesn't say if we have the low spots ahead. It says the low spots ahead. And today is my turn. Today is my turn of the low spots, you know. But I have my home group. I knew where I was coming tonight. I knew who was driving tonight. I knew who was going to be your 10-minute speaker. And I don't know about you guys, that gives me a sense of safety. You know, even if it was Lancaster. I got off I think it was Circle K or something. Whoa. It's been a minute. There's a level of safety knowing that I'm in my home group Monday night, knowing that I'm at my 11-step study meeting on a Tuesday night, knowing that I'm in my big book study Wednesday night, in my little 12-on-12 on Thursday night. And if I can't make it for whatever reason, my sponsor knows where I'm at. There's a certain, you know, safety in that for me. At 62 years old, 33 years sober, I don't get to, like, miss meetings and not let my sponsor know. And some of the girls that are expecting me at the meeting, I don't get to hide anymore. And so for me, I've been doing tough, I've been doing grief in sobriety with you guys. I don't like it. I don't like to not feel good in meetings. I like coming to meetings when I feel good. When I'm smiling and I'm touching and I'm embracing and I'm hugging and farting with all of you guys, I like that. But coming in here when I'm hurting and it hurts for me to, you know, you approach me, you want to hug me and it hurts my skin. You know, that's what grief looks like for me sometimes, you know. And as a human being, we all go through grief. We all lose people in sobriety if you stay long enough. You know, and for me, grief has teeth. It's always had teeth from the very beginning that I lost somebody I love. And unfortunately, the older we get and the longer we're here, the more we see it of people we love. The only consolation that I can leave you with, you guys, on that is that if you let us, we will be there for you. But I have to let you in. I have to answer the phone. I have to let Terry know what's going on in my heart. And she's an insister. She won't take I'm okay for today. She'll call me tomorrow and say, how you doing? She'll call me Wednesday. I'm just calling to check in. How you doing? You know? And you know, and I have a handful of friends like that, you know, that won't let me rest in my laurels. You know, and I got people that are knocking on my door, and I got, you know, I get all this attention that I don't know what to do with it, because even though I crave it, I like attention. Let me be the center of attention. I like it. You know, when it's hurtful, I can't stand it. I'm raw. And so I'm learning how to do this with you guys. You know, it is my time to quit. I'm going to tell you that I love you guys and there's nothing that you can do about it. Mark, thank you so much. Keep coming back. I will.